Okay, well, I should say, first of all, as you'll spot fairly quickly, these are kind of related papers. We seem to have sort of independently in Luxembourg and Surrey come across the idea of introducing a confirmation code mechanism into the prêt-à-voter scheme. But I think our approaches are somewhat different, and I listened with interest to the discussion just at the end. I think I have a rather different approach to the Surrey approach on whether we do away with receipts, but we'll come to that in a moment. Okay, so this was the outline. In fact, a lot of the early stuff I can probably skip over extremely quickly because both Rolf and Chris have probably covered quite a bit of it already. But just to give you the background, and then I'll go into the details of the meat of this talk, which is the introduction of a pretty good democracy-style confirmation code into prêt-à-voter. Okay. So I think I can sort of skip on this. This is a general E2E verifiable type scheme in the tradition of, you know, punch scan, prêt-à-voter, and so on. I think I can probably skip on this. Okay, we're trying to make the, probably the first bullet, which I think is a slogan due to Josh, kind of sums it all up. We're aiming to verify the election rather than the system via and trying to make it as auditable as possible, transparent as possible. The key requirements are sort of fairly standard, I think pretty much in line with what Rolf put up earlier, so I think I'll skip on that. So obviously we want to guarantee integrity, ballot secrecy, coercion resistance, and so forth. Okay, E2E verifiability, as I guess most of you in the audience know, that generally speaking what happens is some kind of encrypted ballot is handed to the voter at the time they cast their vote, and they can use that subsequently to confirm, typically via a web bulletin board, that their receipt has been accurately recorded, and then there's some verifiable tabulation process in the background. So in essence, that's what's going on. So prêt-à-voter, just to quickly remind you, the key idea is in the way that the encoding of the ballot occurs. So in fact, you use, as Chris, I guess, was indicating, pre-prepared paper ballot forms, which certainly to a UK voter look sort of fairly familiar, but the key trick is that each ballot form has an independently randomized candidate list, and there's some information on the ballot form which defines that in sort of encrypted, hidden form, that ordering, but which ultimately is used in the tabulation process to reconstruct the vote. So typical prêt-à-voter ballot would look like that. So Chris, I guess, has sort of outlined, well, actually I give the ceremony, I think, in the next slide, but just to do some cool animation, I'm just getting into grips with Keynote, it's really cool. So the voter probably gets one of these sealed in an envelope, goes off to the booth, takes it out of the envelope, they mark cross against their candidate of choice, they then destroy. How cool is that? Okay, and that now forms a receipt, and I guess many of you sort of familiar with that. Okay, so the voting ceremony, I think I can probably sort of skip over that. Well, basically they now exit the booth, they go back to the election officials, the information on that receipt is scanned, posted to the web bulletin board, etc., etc. Okay, and the voter can now head off contentedly clutching the receipt. Okay, and tabulation is sort of fairly standard once things are on the web bulletin board and sort of agreed and so on and so forth. So I think I can skip on all of that, yeah? Okay, so just a few quick remarks. How are we doing? Well, hopefully it's obvious to anyone in this room that such a receipt conceals what the candidate choice is. The voter experience is, I think, fairly simple, and to a UK voter, fairly familiar, I mean, apart from the flaming half of the ballot. A nice feature of this is that votes are not sort of directly encrypted. A lot of other schemes, as you're probably aware, involves the voter, you know, touching a screen or something to indicate their choice, and then some encryption goes on, and then maybe there's some Benelux-type challenges and so on and so forth. What's quite nice here is you'll observe that the voter never communicates their choice to any device, so you sidestep a lot of side-channel kind of attacks. And a nice feature also is that the auditing process is now, in a sense, rather clean. because the key point, obviously, for the integrity of the vote or the correctness of the encoding is that the ballots are well formed, and you can audit that, and that's an issue purely of the ballot form, completely independent of the choice, any candidate choice that the voter subsequently makes. So that makes the auditing kind of cleaner in some sense. And of course, it can be adapted to ranked voting, as Chris was indicating. I won't talk about that in this talk. Okay, so I also need, we're going to do this all in time, I suppose a 1 minute overview of code voting. I guess most of you know it because it's the basis for pretty good democracy. So the idea is that voters get individual code sheets via some supposedly secure channel like the mail. Don't laugh too much. Code sheets look like this. So I've departed from tradition. I gave a talk like this in Norway, so these are Nordic gods. So you've got a bunch of vote codes and acknowledgement codes. Okay, so you go to a portal, you perhaps authenticate yourself in some way, you provide the serial number of your code sheet and the voting code of choice, and the system should come back with the correct ACT code for that choice, okay? So that's kind of quite nice. It sidesteps a lot of internet's insecurities. And the ACT code sort of serves a dual purpose, partly to sort of give a confirmation the correct code has reached the server, and it also, I guess, to some extent authenticates the server, that you're talking to a genuine server. But of course, the server knows all of these codes, and this is clearly not end-to-end verifiable because you don't really, okay, so your correct code has been registered by the vote server, but how that's subsequently interpreted and tabulated, really, you have no, the rest is on pure faith in some sense. So Pretty Good Democracy is a scheme that Vanessa and I came up with a few years back, which tries to at least raise the bar a little bit, give us a higher degree of end-to-end verifiability. And really the key twist here is that rather than having the vote server know all of these codes, immediately have a sort of access to a database. Now the knowledge of these codes is secret shared amongst a set of trustees. Okay, I won't have time to go into the sort of details of cryptographic setup, but it's... And one other little sort of technical detail to make it receipt-free, we, instead of having a distinct ACT code for each candidate, we now have a single ACT code per code sheet. Okay, so it's much, the voting process is much as with code voting. Voter logs on, sends off their vote code, but now there's a process which, again, I won't go into the details, but it involves sort of threshold PET testing by the trustees. When in fact what gets posted to the web bulletin board is an encryption under the appropriate public key of the code, and then the trustees do threshold PET tests against pre-committed encryptions, and if they find a match, then that shows that it's a valid code and it's flagged on the web bulletin board and thereby registered. And at that point, if the trustees have collectively found such a match, they then decode the appropriate ACT code from the web bulletin board, and it can now be sent back to the voter. Okay, so the point of all this is that now if you get the correct ACT code back, that is fairly convincing evidence that a threshold of trustees collaborated to register the vote. Okay, now of course there are some weaknesses here. And tabulation is sort of much as before with prêt-à-voter. But there are already two crucial assumptions here which arguably are quite seriously vulnerabilities with this. One is we need to assume that the vote codes aren't leaked somehow. Okay, it should be, I guess, immediately obvious to you that if we get leakage of codes, this whole process can be undermined. I guess people were hinting at that in the discussion earlier. And we're also, of course, assuming that there isn't a threshold set of trustees colluding against the voters. Okay, so they're quite sort of serious problems, but nonetheless, I mean, I think our feeling is that we've raised the bar a little bit against code voting, but I think Vanessa and I would agree we wouldn't advocate this for serious political binding elections. Okay, so now with hopefully a little bit of time left, I get to the meat of the talk. So for me, the idea was what happens if we combine the techniques from both prêt-à-voter and Pretty Good Democracy. Okay, I should have said at the outset, obviously, prêt-à-voter is a polling station supervised scheme. Pretty Good Democracy is an internet scheme. So what I'm proposing here is, again, it's a polling station supervised scheme, but where we introduce this confirmation code technique from Pretty Good Democracy into it. okay, in such a way that now the voter gets an, should get an immediate confirmation code at the time they cast their vote in the polling station. Okay. So just to give you a very quick indication, I don't have the time, obviously, going into all the details, they're in the paper. We have a setup phase, so we commit essentially a large table to the web bulletin board. Each row of this table will correspond to one of the ballots. Okay, and so there's a sort of typical one. So in fact, each cell of this table is a pair. So the first part, say, is an encryption of an appropriate confirmation code, and the second part will be encoding of a candidate index. Okay, and you'll notice that in each row, you should have a permutation of these candidate indices. Okay, and there's actually a nice distributed construction to do this in such a way that no single entity knows the plain text information here. Okay, and of course we need to audit all of this for consistency. So we commit this stuff to the web bulletin board. Then of course there's a process of having to print the appropriate information to ballot forms. That's a bit problematic. I'll get back to that, time permitting, later. But we obviously have to do random audits in the usual fashion to check for consistency between what's been committed to the web bulletin board and what gets printed to the ballot forms. And of course we have chain of custody issues and so forth in the usual way. Okay, so a typical sort of pair of a row on the bulletin board and a ballot might look as such. Okay, so you can see, and I think I got the Ryan standard permutation right, did I? Yeah, good. Okay, you should see that the candidates, if you think of them sort of alphabetical order, their ordering matches the encrypted permutation buried up there, and the codes, of course, are just in the corresponding order. Okay, so in reality, there's actually an extra twist that, for reasons I'll come to if I have time, we actually initially, when the ballot is presented to the voter, these codes are actually concealed, either by a scratch strip or perhaps by invisible ink techniques. Okay, so I get to do it all again. So again, the voter goes off to the booth, crosses Odin in this case, destroys the left-hand strip, and now goes to the officials again. The information is again scanned in the usual prêt-à-voter fashion. So the index indicating the position of the cross and the serial number gets sent off to the web bulletin board. Okay, now a threshold set of trustees come together, register that. We don't need PET tests at this stage, right, because we're just dealing with a sort of plain text index. And again, they register and decrypt and send back the code. Okay, once the code is announced back at the polling station, then the voter, whoops, there we go, scratches off the strip and reveals the code. And that should agree with a code that's come back from the web bulletin board, from the trustees. Okay, that I think just describes the ceremony again, which I'll probably skip over for brevity. Okay, of course we need to worry about recovery mechanisms if things go wrong, but again, that's I don't have time to look into that now. Okay, so the tabulation is now fairly straightforward. Basically, once the election's over, any sort of disputes are resolved, then basically we just take the flagged candidate indices and push them into a homomorphic tabulation or mixed tabulation. Okay, so let's get into discussion of some aspects of this. I've obviously skipped a lot over a lot of the technical details, but you can find them in the paper. So notice, first of all, at least in the first cut of this, I'm not proposing that we do away with the receipts. This is sort of quite a long discussion that I've had with Chris and others. I am still thinking in terms of retaining a receipt, and there are all these issues of verifying the digital signature, which we've always had. As you, I'm sure, know, the usual response to this is that there are sort of a voter assistance people on hand with devices that can check the signatures on the spot. Whether that's feasible or practical is, of course, debatable. I'll come on to a bit later my take on whether we could dispense with the receipts in a second. There's quite an interesting discussion there, I think. So let's see the points. Strictly speaking, the voters arguably could be content with just getting the correct code back at the time in the polling station. So they don't necessarily, if they don't feel inclined, they don't have to then go and visit the web bulletin board. and arguably in some sense we're less reliant on the voters doing that because we've got this additional mechanism, confirmation of registration of votes. Notice we've gone back to an individual code for each candidate because we've got the prêt-à-voter underlying mechanism. We don't violate receipt freeness by doing so. Okay, I'll come back in a second to this discussion of whether we could perhaps do away with the receipts altogether. Arguably, it's kind of more convenient for the voters. They can view it as a pure vote, check, go process. And arguably, maybe it's more conducive of trust. I mean, maybe this confirmation code mechanism will give voters a warm feeling. I don't know, that's psychology, but since the acceptability of these schemes is perhaps one of our major challenges now, maybe things like this are actually more important than we would imagine as geeks. So just a few little comments about the underlying construction. There's actually a very nice, well, I think it's nice, distributed construction of all this. And basically, we generate a large batch of codes of the appropriate form. We encrypt them publicly, and then we put them through a series of mixers, and then we assemble them into the table. So the point of that is that you'd basically have to have a collusion of all the entities to work out what the set of codes for any ballot form actually is. Okay, but of course, having had this rather nice distributed construction, we're then faced with the fact that at some point we have to sort of extract this information, print it, and distribute it. And of course, there is the sort of soft underbelly of this. Again, I discussed this a bit in the paper. I don't really have time to go into the details. It would be really nice to have some sort of distributed way of extracting and doing the printing and so forth. We could potentially use something along the lines that Alex and others suggested, which I guess uses visual crypto and invisible ink techniques. In the paper, I suggested a sort of alternative which doesn't give you quite such a sort of pure secret sharing, but achieve something. It's a bit clunky. In essence, the idea is that, say, we've got four-digit codes, we basically set up four clerks. One clerk is responsible for the first digits of the codes, the second clerk for the second digits, and so on. And so basically the first clerk will start off and extract all the first digits, print them, and maybe cover them with scratch strips or print them in invisible ink, and then the second clerk takes over and does the same for the second digits, okay? So again, no sort of single entity knows the codes in full. It's kind of clunky, but it maybe helps a bit. Okay, yes, I can do that in 2 minutes. Okay, so to conclude, arguably this is a potentially interesting enhancement to prêt-à-voter. We need to think quite hard about exactly how it changes the security. I mean, in some sense, on the superficially, it would just seem to improve it, in the sense we've added an extra registration confirmation mechanism to the original prêt-à-voter. On the other hand, you could argue that we're already concerned about the proportion of voters who will do the checks in conventional prêt-à-voter or other schemes of this nature. Maybe getting the confirmation code, correct confirmation code back, will induce even less people, induce a false sense of security. And as I think was touched on in the previous talk, as with pretty good democracy, the confirmation code mechanism could be undermined by, say, leakage of code information. So in some sense, it's a less secure way of verifying the registration than the conventional techniques. Okay, it's no longer sort of unconditional. It's subject to various assumptions. So personally, I would feel very nervous about advocating doing away with the conventional receipt mechanism and checking against the web bulletin board. But maybe there are arguments for that. I mean, Chris has argued that the problem with verifying the digital signatures on the spot is a problem. There are other, perhaps, arguments that voters walking away with the receipt perhaps introduces possibility of psychological attacks if you persuade the voters that their vote can be extracted from the receipt. So maybe we could, there are perhaps various middle routes. Okay, we could adopt a verified encrypted paper audit trail, as has been suggested previously, for conventional prêt-à-voter. Or rather interestingly, we could sort of converge a bit with Scantegrity. Okay, you'll notice that the mechanism, as with Scantegrity, ensures that the voter only gets to learn the single confirmation code of choice. So we can actually adopt the scantigraphy type way of confirming and sort of backing up a challenge. I should also mention that I want to talk more to Dan about possible links with VoteBox. Okay, so that was basically it. I'd like to thank various people who've helped with the development of Prêt-à-Voter and Pretty Good Democracy over the years, and also the FNR for funding support. Okay, thank you.
Hi, David Bismarck, University of Surrey. I want to point out that when Peter came up with Prêt-à-Voter, it was because we wanted to remove trust from machines. We don't want to tell the machine how we're voting, because then it could run some malicious code and change the vote. So we're trusting this piece of paper, and instead of trusting a machine or trusting people. So coming back to what Alex raised, I wanted to show how these two schemes are very similar. So our scheme that Chris presented and the scheme that Peter has presented are similar in that we're using this chain of custody. We're using the secret paper ballot form that's always been around in Prêt-à-Voter to add extra integrity checks. So coming back to what Alex said is, we're not relying on the chain of custody to keep the integrity in our scheme. And it's the same with Peter's scheme. So if you break the chain of custody of the paper ballot form in these two schemes, you don't automatically break the integrity of the election. You also have to hack a machine or hack the web bulletin board or something. So if we say, which both we and Peter do, that the digital signatures don't work, then we're actually going somewhere towards fixing that. Do you see what I mean?
But the difference is that if you can do that, if you can break the integrity chain of custody, you're right, you need an additional step to break the integrity. But if you can then do that, then all of the proofs would check out, and it would actually be worse than in a conventional election, because you would have all of the seemingly beautiful cryptographic proofs proving something that it didn't actually prove.
Yeah, okay.
Well, if I may be permitted to. I mean, it occurs to me we're not relying purely on chain of custody, you know, I think, as I understand chain of custody, because we also propose that, you know, before, during, and even after the election, we do continue to do random checks of ballots and check the consistency against the web bulletin board. So it's not pure chain of custody, you know, I think, the way I understand it, unless I misunderstand it. Ah, you're supposed to stand by the mic, apparently.
So that is actually coming back to what Vanessa said, because that is what we do. We audit the ballot forms in Prêt-à-Voter to make sure that they are correctly constructed. And that's why we trust the chain of custody of the ballot forms, because we audit them. And that's the same in both of these schemes.
Okay. I guess we can keep this conversation during the break. Let's thank the speaker again.